Hello and happy anniversary, Blogging Heads Nation. This is a special fifth birthday week appearance between me, Heather Hurlbert at the National Security Network, and
Eli Lake of Washington Times and New Republic. We've done many of these, Heather.
We have. I've actually kind of lost track of how many we've done. Today there's something a little different, which you cannot see, but that the commentators will immediately notice, which is that, yes, I am wearing my glasses. And, yes, I am wearing my glasses in tribute to the number of tears I have shed over Russ Feingold, Mark Schauer, Tom Perriello, Phil Hare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Patty Mary is a silver lining for you.
Actually, let's jump right into it. I mean, to me, in fact, the silver lining is that we have a shocking number of moderate or sort of retread new senators, or old new senators in the case of Dan Coats. So we've been saying around here, and this is an outrageous excuse to add a link to our clip when we post it, but we've been referring to this as the Welcome Back Cotter Senate.
I came up with that on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter, so I think it's a case of great minds.
No, I know. I came up with my theme songs were for the Republicans, the Welcome Back Cotter theme song, because the names have all changed since you come around,
yep.
Right?
but the dreams still remained.
Right. And then my theme song for the Democrats was Melissa Manchester's Don't Cry Out Loud.
That is a very good theme song for Nancy Pelosi, actually. I really like that. I have one more point on this to add, which is that someone asked this morning, okay, Heather, that's fine, but who's Horshack? So the office immediately came back and said Rand Paul is Horshack.
Interesting. I actually am angling for an interview with Rand Paul to just sort of sit down with him for like an hour and say, okay, like, tell me about your philosophy on national security and foreign policy. Because I'm of the belief that when someone's running for office, they never are going to be as, you know what I'm saying? Like, you don't want to get Dick Lugar when he's running for Senate. You want to get him, like, you know, after the election. And then he'll tell you, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it was really striking to look. I actually did a presentation earlier this morning where I was supposed to be telling an advocacy group what this all means. And I was asked the question about the philosophy of the newly elected senators on national security. And I said, you know, very few of them give evidence of having a philosophy. And some of these guys who come, especially the folks from the ag states, who, you know, appear to be in the great prairie tradition that we have, that your basic philosophy about international affairs is sell as much wheat and chickens as possible.
Right.
Rand Paul, for better and for worse, I think is one of the, frankly, few incumbents we have this cycle who does have a really coherent philosophy, although the way he chooses to pick and choose from it while he's running isn't especially coherent. So I'll really look forward to what he has to say to you. But what
See,
do you make
I would argue that the ag state, that was true 30 years ago. But the influence of the evangelical movement and sort of the wider social conservatism has created a Wilberforce, for lack of a better word. So you have this kind of, there's also a sense that American foreign policy should come to the aid of the victims of Islamic radicalism. So I think in that respect you see a lot of pro-Israel sentiment among traditional kind of representatives from these ag states because of the influence of the evangelicals. But that is also coupled with, you know, I think a very strong kind of moral outrage at the government in Sudan, for example, or the treatment of religious minorities in Saudi Arabia or China. And that, in some ways, does kind of clash up against the notion that, like, well, it's good for Iowa to sell as much corn and wheat to whoever will buy it.
Well, Eli, that is that's the neocon spin that there's sort of nothing. I would expect nothing less from you, but it's
well,
interesting.
I don't know. I think that's a neocon spin. I think it's been largely. I mean, if you look at the Republicans.
Well, and actually, it's somewhat surprising if you look at Hoeven from North Dakota, if you look at Moran from Kansas, that in fact they don't have as much of that on their websites and in their campaign materials as I would have expected them to. And then if you look at somebody like Johnson from Wisconsin, who beat Feingold, or Mike Lee from Utah, who defeated Senator Bennett in the primary, that both of them have actually taken what looks much more like an isolationist stance. And I don't feel very confident that that's going to hold up. I think one of the most interesting things we're going to see in the Senate and the House in the next 6 to 12 months is a real battle for the souls of some of these guys. And, you know, the one of the most interesting things, of course, for me about this election is that whatever else it wasn't a referendum on national security.
I agree with that.
A shocking thing, you know, really surprising to me, was that in the exit polls, a majority of voters gave relatively good marks to the administration on its national security policy. And, you know, Charlie Cook commented that actually, ironically, the administration did so well at taking national security off the table that it didn't benefit from what people think is its relatively decent stewardship. So what I sort of expect we're going to see is that a number of these newcomers are going to see foreign policy and national security votes as freebies where they can express on issues like Iran, like China, which we'll get to discussing in a minute, where they can express sort of whatever they think their base or their funders or the people they're trying to angle for in the presidential primaries want them to at relatively little cost. And the challenge for those of us, wherever we sit ideologically, who want to see a more responsible centrist or even progressive foreign policy, is going to be how to figure out to impose some costs on some of those votes.
Well, I actually disagree with you because...
I'm shocked.
Okay, well, let me... I think what happened was that in 2008, the traditional kind of counterbalance in the Republican Party against the neocons, the realists, a lot of them ended up supporting Obama. And I think that was pretty much spelled the end of the kind of Scowcroft tradition in the party, because so many people, including Colin Powell, like a great example, ended up endorsing Obama. And what you ended up basically seeding the field in terms of policy experts to, for lack of a better word, neoconservatives, though I do think that in this particular case, I would stress that it was a matter of like sort of seeding the field in that sense. And then if you look at the leadership of in terms of Boehner and McConnell and others, you see, I mean, like, for example, McConnell's a guy who does come from an ag state, comes from the same state as Rand Paul. He was instrumental in bringing most Republicans sort of keeping them from defecting on the surge when the costs were much higher and there was a much more of a populist temptation to kind of join the get out of Iraq chorus. Now that we're sort of beyond that and you've got what I think is Obama embracing what was pretty much a Bushian strategy of like leaving, you know, a kind of overwatch force and taking more time and having a results based, though that's
Eli,
debatable.
The Bush strategy in Afghanistan was complete neglect.
Afghanistan, I said Iraq. Are you there?
Okay, so...
So I'm saying a Bushian strategy in Iraq of like leaving, like, you know, there's 50,000 troops there. There's still the U.S. is a major player on the supply lines. There is some grumbling, I think, from the military that are the MNFI that's left in Iraq that they'd like more surveillance resources and stuff
so
like
this,
that.
This
but
is a great moment for a blogging head's greatest hits pitch, because you and I have had before in extensive detail the argument about whether and how that strategy was forced on Bush by a combination of progressives and the Iraqis. So we won't have it again, but I'll refer viewers to the archives.
I'm just saying, it's pretty clear that Obama did not embrace the, like, you know, like, I want everybody out of Iraq, you know, by a certain date. There are 50,000 troops there. They are going to continue to be Iraq's effective air force. They're going to continue to train the military. They're going to continue to basically be the supply line for the Iraqi military. That is much closer, I think, to Kagan than it is to the Baker-Hamilton group. But that said, I think the real challenge right now for the new Republicans on foreign policy is not going to be in Iraq or maybe even Afghanistan, though you could see more grumbling there because it's a hotter war and it doesn't seem like we're doing as well. I think it's going to be on the defense budget itself. Because if the Tea Party and if the new kind of power in the Republican Party means anything, it means cutting the deficit. It means cutting government spending. And certainly Medicare and Social Security are a bigger part of the pie than the defense budget, but the defense budget is still one-fifth of the federal budget.
And more than 50% of all discretionary spending, I might add. So
yes,
when you hear people talking about discretionary spending, it's just not credible if they're not talking about the defense budget.
So we will link to a story that I wrote that came out, I think, on Election Day or the day after, I forget, but I wrote it last week, on looking at this question, which I think is going to pit the traditional kind of Washington-based leadership, the Republican Party, which doesn't want to see defense cuts. And then I think it would be interesting to sort of see where some of the conservatives are. Jim DeMint, you know, has, I think, some hard questions to ask. And you can't just say, I'm for spending cuts on, you know, health care, but I don't touch defense. And, you know, interesting, I interviewed Pete Hoekstra, who's leaving Congress, but he's the former chairman of the, and now the ranking member of the intelligence community. And he said, absolutely, the position for the new Republicans should be, you know, cut defense from the pre-stimulus levels and cut along with the rest of the budget. And he said, you know, I can find 10% of the budget I could cut out of the intelligence community's like $80 billion a year. And he's a guy who's, I guess, in a position to know.
Well, that's easy to say when you're on your way out of Congress. It would have been great if he'd said it while he was still.
No, he was. But, Hoekstra was pretty tough. Hoekstra was tough on the intelligence community, I should say. If you go back, he and Mike Hayden clashed an awful lot. So there was
no Eli to violently agree with you on this point. You know, Tom Coburn, who's on the Bipartisan Deficit Reduction Commission, has been very outspoken in calling for defense to be included in cuts. Ron Paul, who partnered with Barney Frank on this Sustainable Defense Task Force, in which I participated, hint, hint, wink, wink, which actually proposed a very extensive menu of cuts from which people could choose as a way of thinking about just how much scope there is to reform and improve what the Pentagon does and how it does it. So, there's going to be a really fascinating, I think, fight about this. And you already see... you know, Heritage really gearing up very strongly and really trying to put pressure on both new and current members not to back off this. And you had Buck McKeon, who's the incoming chairman of House Armed Services, actually propose an increase in the defense-based budget, which is, you know, novel, if nothing else. So this is going to be one of the most interesting, you know, both political and ideological fights of the next
Well, does not fit into our schedule we talked about, but I would say I just came from this geospatial intelligence conference where I saw the leaders of the intelligence community and General Cartwright, who's the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When he talked about what he said two things on this very issue. He said, one, there's going to be cuts, and we're going to have to absorb them. By the way, so did James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence. And this is basically a room full of defense contractors who are building amazing technology to censor and snoop on and basically the true big brother eye in the sky. And but the one thing that the military wants, and I think I'm quoting it directly, he said, when I'm on the phone with General Petraeus, when I get my love notes every morning from General Petraeus, he says, I need, you know, 800% more intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And those are the aircraft, the blimps, and things that you would hang on a tree that would be able to give you everything from the electromagnetic field to full motion video of a given discrete area. And so that's the one area the Defense Department is looking to really expand and invest in, whereas traditional things that military and the Pentagon build, like MX missiles and B-1 bombers, I think that there are going to be less of those.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of going to be one of the interesting sub-issues within this is, do you invest in personnel, or how do you change the relative balance among investing in personnel, investing in traditional hardware, and investing in sort of cutting-edge flashy stuff? And, you know, the trouble is when you're fighting two land wars, you've got to invest in personnel, and personnel are really expensive. But, you know, to put it another way...
That's the story of Gates and Obama's Pentagon, which is that he has slashed budget, he slashed weapons programs like F-22, but he's increased like health insurance for veterans, and he's increased, I think he had a pay raise for infantry for enlisted guys.
Well, so, you know, the pay raise thing, there's actually a really interesting story about that I have to say I was unaware of until I started working on the task force, which is that what tends to happen on the pay raises that's really symptomatic of the big bipartisan problem here is that the Pentagon comes up with whatever pay raise it thinks, and it recommends that to Congress, and then Congress usually increases it. So that you're actually, which is, you know, as I say, symptomatic of this wider problem where the Pentagon knows there'll have to be cuts, although the Pentagon's definition of cuts versus other people's definition of cuts is interesting. The defense industry knows there are going to be cuts. There have been massive layoffs and buyouts. Lockheed Martin offered a buyout in August, September, and I think the senior executives accepting it were sort of three times what they had thought it was going to be. There's unprecedented consolidation and merger activity among mid-level defense firms because they all know that there's going to be less business. So the only people who sort of haven't gotten the word about defense not being the free-for-all that it has been in the years since 9/11 is Congress. And that's a bipartisan problem. And as I say, it's going to be, you know, it's just a fascinating issue where it's completely unclear where party loyalty is going to trump and where actual ideology and views about deficit size of government are going to trump. And it's just going to be, you know, there's an opportunity here to change how the Pentagon does business, both from the inside and from the outside, that you know, we really haven't had in a very long time. And it's just going to be fascinating to see what happens with it. And maybe with that...
I agree with you in that.
We should move briefly to talk about China.
Then we should get back to the eye in the sky.
Right. So we had originally sort of said, and, you know, sort of the move from the defense budget to China is a logical one, because when your largest... peer competitor, both economically and militarily, is a China, which on the one hand is starting from an incredibly low base defense-wise, which makes some of the talk of the scaremongering talk about China kind of ridiculous. But on the other hand, is building up at a very rapid rate and has, you know, sees the Pacific as its regional lake. There's no, both of those things are true. So how do
they have
like
a Monroe Doctrine for the Yellow Sea, and like, yeah, I think that they're taking the same attitude that the United States has taken historically to the Caribbean and the Western Hemisphere, to their hemisphere. And there were, like, you know, there were IR theorists, most notably, I think, John Mearsheimer, before he started engaging in his Israel lobby fetish. But he was warning, I think, in the 90s a lot. And if you read his book... The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, he gets into this idea that, like, sooner or later, the Chinese are going to be like, well, this is our hemisphere. Get out of Taiwan. So I think that that's kind of where it's heading. And it's interesting because the Obama administration, which has pursued reset with Russia, which we've talked about, and, you know, is criticized, I think, by the right of being, you know, wanting to just sort of make nice with everyone, actually has been kind of tough on China. They managed to do a Taiwan arms sale almost a little over a year after they were in office. It took Bush like 7 years to do that. And I think after the Chinese really dissed Obama at the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit, we've seen a very different posture, most notably this trip that Hillary Clinton has just ended, going and making sure to visit all of the U.S. allies that kind of encircle China. And so the fact of those visits themselves, you know, send a kind of interesting message. And, you know, more and more, the sense that I'm getting is that the Obama administration is very frustrated and very worried about Chinese behavior on any number of issues, whether it's diplomatically on the Iran sanctions, whether it's their position on rare earth minerals and what appears to be an attempt to totally monopolize all rare earth minerals needed for manufacture of computer chips and other high-tech equipment, or for that matter, their currency manipulation. And I wanted to talk about this because a couple weeks ago I wrote about the prospect of Huawei, a Chinese telecom company, putting their components in the U.S. 4G network and the cell towers of the 4G network, and how this is sort of an issue before the intelligence community right now and in before Sprint. And the concern from a lot of people in the intelligence community is it would give China basically a listening post throughout the United States on the cell phone. And we're like, wow, that's just like our NSA, Heather. So
I was going to say, I'm looking at my formerly IBM, now Chinese ThinkPad, and I'm thinking, why do the Chinese need cell phone towers if they want to have listening posts throughout America? They've got.
Well,
that's
the thing, is that the Chinese have proven very adept, and we always talk about this in the press as Chinese hackers, like they're like Chinese, you know, 18-year-olds in their mother's basement eating Hot Pockets. But in fact, I've been doing some research. I'm going to do a larger piece that you'll see in a magazine in the next month or so. But on this question of the Chinese really have developed a capability to, you know, read email of groups that they don't like that are criticizing their policy against the Falun Gong, for example. They've hacked into the Dalai Lama websites. They've also hacked into, like, Congressman Frank Wolf's emails and in the Commerce Department as well. So there's a lot of things that they've done that looks like a pretty coordinated government effort. And if you talk to people in Cyber Command, for example, at least on background, then one of the things that they will say is that China is their number one threat. And this is something that, while it's not the same technically as how the NSA does it, because the United States has this incredible surveillance advantage because all of the fiber optic cables kind of all come to the nerve center of the United States physically, right? If they do have, in some ways, are developing the same kind of surveillance capability.
Well, you know, the thing I think that's going to bedevil us on China policy for the rest of our lives, right, mm-hmm. is that the complexity and size of China in every respect, we've never had to deal with a country that is possibly more complex than the U.S. is. And so that, you know, from the political level where it's very clear that just as there's an internal debate in the U.S. about China, there's an internal debate in China about the U.S. There's a debate among the elites about how they should relate to us. There's the fact that, you know, sort of nativist rhetoric and anti-U.S. baiting is very popular in China, just as we saw here during the campaign. I mean, this hasn't been discussed much at all, but China's really the international issue that played the most in the campaign on a quite bipartisan basis, and, you know, yet it didn't...
Remember the ad against Rob Portman?
Well,
they showed the thing and it was part of the Chinese flag. It was like, whoa, dude.
Well,
that was against a Republican. It was against a Republican.
Yeah, but there was that parallel ad that was run against a number of Democrats that featured the Chinese professor lecturing to the students that then Campus Progress did a very funny parody of, which then ironically someone went after them for fair use on. So China, politically very complex. The issue that you've just raised of, I mean, because for sure some of what we're seeing is incredibly talented Chinese young people in their basements eating whatever the Chinese.
It's not. It's more. I think it's more than that.
But some of it, as you say, is probably more than that.
The PLA has a whole division that's like the equivalent of our NSA, and it's like at this point we have to start. I would say this. The U.S. had, and not just the U.S., there's something called the Five Eyes and something called the UK-USA Treaty, which was a signal intelligence sharing treaty with the five English-speaking countries and not including New Guinea. So it was U.S., Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and New Zealand. And this was a treaty that basically gave these five countries, the Five Eyes, E-Y-E-S, the ability to listen to phone calls, read email, and so forth. And there was a program in the 90s called Echelon, which I'm sure you remember when you were in the National Security Council. And what's happened is that you could argue that the U.S. or the Anglosphere's monopoly of surveillance is now effectively challenged by other countries, most notably China.
Well, I would be careful in asserting that the U.S. ever had a monopoly of surveillance.
There well, a monopoly a number, in
there are
in terms
a number
of capabilities,
of smaller
certainly.
Intelligence
yeah.
services that punch way above their weight. That, but anyway,
the Israelis certainly have a pretty impressive capability, but it's not the unique advantage the United States had in both the kind of satellite when you had a lot of phone calls relayed over microwave was the satellite advantage in the 80s and 90s, and then you saw in the late 90s the transfer to fiber optic, and because all those fiber optic cables came through the United States, literally the U.S. in many ways because of the unique placement of our industry was sort of the nerve center for the world fiber optic network, that gave the U.S. An advantage starting in the, well, depends on who you,
so,
who's
so
account
here,
you made.
It's very
secret.
I don't want to sound blasé about this because I do recognize that it's an incredibly important issue, but welcome to the 21st century. I mean, this is every other issue. And so the larger point about China policy that I was getting to in my discursive fashion is that it's fascinating how far across the ideological spectrum, and not everybody, but there's just a much broader than you would expect swath of people in the middle that says the right answer for dealing with China is a combination of figuring out how to be firm where you need to be and flexible everywhere else. And that, number one, we actually have this big problem that nobody can really enunciate that in public as the core of a strategy. And number two, of course, is the fighting over where is necessary and where is flexible. But that if you actually look at, you know, a quite broad swath of people who were in the Bush NSC on China to people who were too liberal to be in the Clinton NSC on China, that's sort of where people come out, and which is a fascinating thing to me. But as I say, because we're actually sort of arguing over the implementation, but the public dialogue on China is so different that we can't say that, that we're just going to end up, I think, having stupid fight after stupid fight after stupid fight, which frankly gives the Chinese a really significant advantage in dealing with us.
Well, firm where you need to be, flexible where you don't need to be firm. I mean, it's a little too abstract. I mean, I want to get into, I think that there's some important issues ahead, right? One of them is, what's our relationship like going to be with Taiwan? In, I think, 1982, the Reagan administration signed a memo that the Chinese believe, you know, would commit us to eventually phase out our arms sales to Taiwan and certainly phase out anything that would be qualitatively or quantitatively better than the arms that we sold them in 1982. That has never happened for a variety of reasons. So what is the future U.S. policy going to be towards Taiwan? They desperately would love to get an upgrade on their fighter jets and other things like that. And, you know, a lot of that will depend on the elected government in Taipei. So that strikes me as like one discrete area that is very thorny, and that's probably something that we're going to have to deal with. And then secondly, I look at this other question, which is that I think China's a great power that doesn't act responsibly like a great power. So there's certain things we want all our great powers to do, like, you know, chip in against pandemics and, you know, be responsible stakeholders against intellectual property right violations. And we can go through the list, right? And China doesn't really do that. They don't act like a great power. So how do we get China to pull its weight on things that affect all of us?
Well,
that's a tough one, right?
See, Tim, actually, well, it's a tough one. How can I put this? It's a very tough one for the people who have to keep chipping away day after day. But, you know, the answer is we just keep plugging away. And there are some areas where there have been significant improvements. And in fact, the thing about China and pandemics is that if, you know, for China to do what it has done, for example, in reversing its terrible AIDS policy, which it had a disastrously awful AIDS policy, which it has reversed. And by the way, which it reversed thanks to a combination of international pressure and domestic pressure, where people mobilized within China and got around internet censorship and really fought and exposed themselves to significant personal hardship. And as a result, China changed its policy, and it's much better now. And arguably, you know, the internal contribution that China's making now on AIDS and some other pandemic diseases is really, really significant. So, you know, totally agreed on the point that we want China to behave in a certain way. Then you've come to the question of when is it useful to run around beating your chest in public about all the things China isn't doing versus where are, you know, again, which fights do you want to pick and which ones do you want to just keep working on in private?
Right.
And there, I think, you know, is where you come sort of essentially to a difference of temperament. And I think, as you said, we've seen the administration make some adjustments as it, frankly, tries to calibrate what it needs to say in public versus what it doesn't need to say in public.
Finally, I would say the other big issue with China is that Chinese foreign policy is, from a human rights perspective, atrocious. It's not just that China is, you know, awful to political and religious minorities that it sees as a threat like the Falun Gong, which is bad enough. It's not just that it's bad enough to the Tibetan, you know, Buddhists. It's terrible in that it is the diplomatic protector of the Burmese junta. It is a country that looks at the government of Sudan and sees it as a business partner for getting more resources. And I think that, like, I just don't think that, you know, you can be very critical of U.S. foreign policy or European foreign policy. I don't think the U.S. or the Europeans could do what the Chinese did in terms of enabling, you know, the destruction of, like, villages when they were building that pipeline in the 1990s in Sudan.
You're forgetting the role of the Norwegian and Swedish state oil companies.
Okay, fine, you're right. The Norwegian and state were not really good, but the Chinese were particularly bad in that respect. And then you just sort of look around the globe and you're like, and you, from a human rights perspective, China is not just bad internally to its 1.1 billion people. It seems to buddy up with some of the worst regimes. And in some ways, it also provides a lifeline to a terrible, atrocious prison state in North Korea as well. So it could do more on that.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you need to caveat that. But Eli,
right.
so here's the question.
I'm not necessarily proposing like a name and shame.
Do you want that to be an exclusively bilateral fight between the U.S.
No.
and China, in which it just becomes yet another issue on which the U.S. is demander? Or is is the way to get at this over time, and this is true, you know, we could have mentioned Iran as well.
Yeah, well, Iran too.
What actually needs to happen is that other countries need to, besides the U.S., and, you know, the Europeans used to be good on this and are less good than they used to be. Can we get other countries, can some of China's big developing country partners, you know, other emerging powers, actually indicate to the Chinese that they also care what China does in Sudan or Burma or with Iran?
Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
That the goal of U.S. policy here has to be, rather than we're just going to throw ourselves out there and sort of devil take the consequences, how can we be rebuilding a broader consensus around those issues that eventually makes it costly for China to take these positions? Because right now, you know, there's no cost to them. And if it frankly just becomes another thing that the U.S. is bullying them about, that's in their favor. And as you said, while I agree with you that U.S. foreign policy is not on a par with Chinese foreign policy in its level of cynicism and indifference about human rights, there are plenty of things that the Chinese can point to and say, excuse me, who are you to lecture us on this? So that, you know, that has to be remedied.
As for the ability, the authority to lecture, what I was going to say finally is that non-government organizations and, dare I say, the international progressive movements, I would love to see them spend more time, just pointing out all the problems of China on the international stage, because it's emerging great power. There's no, debating whether or not we should consider China a great power. I mean, that's over. They are, you have to deal with them. And, you know, finally, I guess I'd say, I don't know this is something that can effectively be done by the U.S. government, per se. In fact, I'm doubtful that the U.S. government could do it. But it would be nice if there were institutions outside of the U.S. government that could effectively nurture, the democratic movements within China without making it seem like it was part of a U.S. foreign policy that would ultimately discredit them and sour our relationship.
Well, I actually, Eli, think there's an enormous, things. One is there's an enormous amount of that happening at a non-governmental level. And number two, that, again, this is a country that's much larger than we are. And so I was reading while I was boning up for this, you know, the China's wealthiest 1% now employ 2 million bodyguards. That's just a random statistic that I saw and found rather fascinating.
That's outrageous.
So, one has to, I think, of all the places in the world where it behooves Americans to approach with great modesty the topic of how to help other people improve their governments, you know, China's very high on that list. And on that note,
that's what I said. Not the U.S. government to do it.
I know we both need to wrap up.
But can we do 5 minutes on geospatial intelligence?
I really apologize, but I can't. I'm actually already five minutes over my cut time. But this has been great fun, and happy anniversary, Blogging Heads.